Testing, 1, 2, 3. This is an interview with Harvey DeGrozier on January 4th, 2008 at Museum LA in Lewiston, Maine. This is Andrea Lungier, and this is the second interview with Harvey for the shoe workers, the Brickmakers Oral History Project. Harvey, could you just talk some more about the kills and that whole process?
Yes. As I told you before, I had about 5 years of experiences or more in the brickyard as a young child and as a teenager and after the Marine Corps. In the process, I did about every job in the brickyard over that period of time. And the ones that I remember the most, the ones we talked about before, I loved making bricks because that was the best paying job in there, and I couldn't wait to get to that level because I made more than my mother and father did together on that job, just making them. However, I did work around the kiln, and that meant handling slabs, and slabs are the outside pieces of the logs that they bring into the mill to make into lumber. Take the slabs off, and those are pieces of wood that have very little value. Mm-hmm. So those brickmakers and other people like that were anxious to get that type of fuel because it was less costly. So we handled a lot of slabs. We handled them green, sometimes dry, but many times green, and some of them were real heavy. We would take those slabs that are real heavy and big and cut them into smaller pieces, and we would have a big piece out of the three slabs. We'd take one slab, make three out of them, and that big piece we'd call a clef. That was a real heavy one. We had long poles with a pick on them, and we'd take these poles and shove that piece of wood in the center of the kiln from one side, and throw short ones. We'd call them dots, dotting. That's what the name of the trade was. You'd be a dotter or a clefer, and I had done all of those. Big experience, you know. But anyway, you learn how to throw them in through that small hole in there. And it was full of flames and red hot bricks in there, and they were melting. It was so hot in there, the bricks would be melting. I couldn't believe it. They had a peephole on top. We had a little brick in there. We'd pull it out so we could see what was happening with the fire, you know. Well, we could stand and just check it over, and it was all red hot in there. And the clay bricks be melting. You could see them melting, dripping down like water.
Yeah.
And all they were was sand and clay dripping down. So anyway, that was one part of it, throwing the slabs in there, and there'd be a line of about four of us lined up. I think it was three or four or five sometimes. One guy was on the pole. One guy was throwing the big slab in as far as he could. Then he'd take the pole and shove it in there. And then the guys behind him would be dotting. They'd throw those pieces in, they would call them dotting. They'd throw them in there until they couldn't get any more wood in.
Right.
And then there was another guy behind that'd be putting a door in. We had cast iron doors and cast iron frames around them. They put the cast iron door in, and they had what they called daubing, which was a mixture of clay and sand. And they'd put it on the outside of the door to seal the doors because a tremendous amount of air'd be going through those cracks. So they want to keep that heat in there to burn those, to cook those bricks. Anyway, those were the three processes. They had the big pieces, the dotters, the pole guys, and all that stuff. And it was that process. Everything be sealed up, and they go in, and everybody get their breath. It was really hot because you had a burlap bag hanging in front of you. You might wet it down to keep the flames off you, keep the heat from coming in you. And you had mittens on and hats and everything. I mean, the heat was terrible. We'd get that side done. We'd take a break because we're all out of breath. Take a break and wait 4 or 5 minutes, rest. Sometimes a little longer than that. I don't remember the period. We'd rest, and then we'd start over again. We'd get one side done, go around the other side, do the same thing. Keep coming around the kiln like that. And that went on for, I don't remember the number of days. It was either 12 or 14 days, night and day. They'd climb up on top of the kiln, see how the fire was doing on top. They had boards on top of it. They had like a shed boards and so forth. They'd open them up to let more air through. They'd close them up to leave more air down there and so forth. They had quite a process. They always have one or two older people
guiding us young people on what to do and how to do it. It was a very rush affair. Then after that period, the kiln would have to cool down, and as it cooled down, it would shrink in a bit because everything would be exhausted of moisture and so forth, and it would just shrink in a bit. And then there was a number of days they would wait again before they opened the kiln up. Then when they'd open it up, they'd take the outside off. And I didn't mention before, but before they started, they'd take all old bricks, broken bricks and so forth, and pack them on the outside of the kiln up, one course up. And as they were doing that, they were just covering the green bricks on the inside, and they were putting like a coating on the outside to keep the heat inside the brick, inside the kiln. And they'd take that apart, layers at a time, because it was very hot in there. And they'd let that cool, and they'd use those over again for the next kiln. They always use the old bricks. There's a lot more I could talk about the kiln, but those were the basic things. Slabs, shrinking the bricks up a bit. They'd get so hot they would melt, which was really hard to believe, you know, but they would melt. They'd get all disformed, you know, bricks that long would be, you know, twice as long. Instead of being 8 inches long, they'd be 16 inches long. They'd be bent all over. It was fascinating to a teenager, you know. It was a lot of work. It kept us very busy. Yes, that's about it on the kiln. But do you have any questions on the kiln?
What did you do with all those bricks that you couldn't, that weren't of quality anymore?
Well, there were different grades. See, the closer the bricks were to the fire, the harder they were as they cooled off. They became glass hard because they had sand and clay in them. And the sand, of course, sand is what they make glass with. And you put them together and hit them, and they go bing. They would ring. Where the outside, the further away you got from the fire, they go boom, boom, and it'd be nothing. So the further away you got from that flame, the weaker the bricks were and the less valuable they were. Some would be reused again and refired, but normally they would be sold not a second, but they'd be different grades. Because in bricklaying, as I understand it, I'm not familiar with the trade, but they would use the better ones on the outside of the building, the exposed side to the wind and rain and ice and storms, because they were so hard, they were not affected by the weather.
Right.
On the inside, where they might have to put two or three layers of bricks, they'd use the softer ones. Okay? Mm. Now, there were some light hards, real yellow ones that were on the outside. I think they cooked them over again. I'm not sure. Because they showed us when we were kids, I remember they took a pail of water, and they said, look at this, Harvey. Take this pail of water and drop that light hard in there. It'd be like a yellow brick. You drop it in and come back the next morning, the water would be all gone.
Hmm.
It would just swallow the water right up. Well, if you took a brick, a hard brick, and dropped it in there, nothing would happen.
Yeah.
It was amazing. So what they did with all of them, I'm not familiar with, but I know that they had very little value.
Right.
I think what they did is they did them over again, but we worked so hard, we really weren't interested in what they were doing. We just wanted to get our pay and get going. You know?
Yeah. And now, so we at the end of the last interview, we were talking about your time in the military. And after that, you went to prep school, is that correct?
Yeah. I was very fortunate. Being an eighth grade dropout, it was at the end of it. The Korean War was just winding down. And my girlfriend's father decided to send her to prep school, so I said, I'm out of here. So I saw my friend Ted, and I said, what do you say we get out of here? And he said, okay, how are you? Let's go. So we went down to the Air Force, and they were full up. We went down to the Army, and they were full up. They had to wait 3 or 4 months at that time. There was just so many people going in. So we went to the Navy, and they said, well, we got 3 or 4 months or so we could take you, but we don't have anything right now, boys. We're full right up. Lo and behold, we were standing in the door and talking to the guy, and across the hall heard us talking. We turned around. There was a fellow sitting behind a desk here with a military uniform. He said, boys, come here. I understand you want to leave. You'd like to leave soon? He said, how'd you like to leave, like tomorrow? We said, what? You would like that? He said, well, come on in. So we went in, and that's how we got into the Marine Corps.
Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't know what we were getting into. We didn't know the Marine Corps from the Salvation Army, you know. We just wanted to get.
Right.
But anyway, it was a hell of an experience.
Yeah.
It was really, quite an experience. It was kind of scary at first. They started a train up in northern Maine in Aroostook County. came down through all the way down to Waterville and down to Lewiston Harbor, down into Portland. Everywhere they stopped, they picked up the Marines.
Yeah.
And the train was full of Marines. We got down to Portland. They unloaded us down there and put us in a hotel and swore us in the next morning on the courthouse steps and took us down and had an examination and everything. And you know, we were just kids, and we were throwing our mattresses out the window and everything. We were raising hell. It was really crazy, but we had a good time.
Yeah.
So anyway, they loaded us on the train next morning. Away we went to Paris Island. We didn't know Paris Island from what that was, and all of a sudden got down and there was moss hanging out of the trees, and I'd never been down south, you know.
Yeah.
And all I could think about was Tarzan movies with snakes running around in trees and stuff, you know. It was kind of scary and spooky, and it was like 1-2 o'clock in the morning. And all of a sudden we got to a gate, and this military guy let us in, and we got in there, and all of a sudden the door opened up and said, "Get out of the car, get out of the parcel." Started screaming at us, you know. Wow, we didn't know what was going on, you know. We got out there and they started hollering at us and standing at attention and don't be smiling and shut your mouth. And the things they were saying to us was unbelievable, you know. Wow. It was scary. So, you know, they made us pick up our bags and put them on our shoulder and everything and said, stand up and do this and do that. And all they did was push us around. But anyway, it was kind of a long, involved thing and scary.
Yeah.
And I hadn't been around people of different nationalities too much, other than Indians and French people and English people. And there were a lot of Mexicans, and when they got us in a group, a lot of Mexicans and Puerto Ricans and colored people there too. So we went out to let us out to do something. And all the white people have to go over here and use the bathroom, and the colored people go over here and use the bathroom. I never heard of that before, you know.
Mm.
And you just want to take a leak. It's okay, you go over there. You go over here. You want a drink of water? White people go over here and get a drink of water. Colored people go over here and drink of water. That's the way it was in the South. We went out the gate, you know, and we go out and we had to split. You had to go on the other side of the tracks if you were a colored guy. And if you were a white guy, you'd stay over on this side, you know. I'd never seen anything like that.
Mm.
It was really, really strange, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was introduced to Jim Crow, whatever they call it at that time, the colored people,
right,
and white people. We didn't have that up here.
Yeah.
So it was quite an experience, especially when I was hitchhiking. I'd hitchhike out there outside the gate a little bit, and then one time I got dropped off in the south someplace down there, and it was a big, long, flat field, and geez, I had no cars coming, you know, no cars coming. I had my uniform on, and pretty soon I see this car way off in the distance, so I put my thumb out, and see this car go by me with five guys in it. They're all colored guys, you know. And I used to hear these stories about how the white guys and the colored guys would get fighting each other. And it was horrible to hear what they'd say and what they were doing to each other, you know. But lo and behold, the car stops, backs up, you know, and said, "Looking for a ride?" I said, "Yes." One guy gets out of the front, so there's four guys sitting in the back and one guy in the front driving. And they're all colored guys. And I get in the front and I said, "Oh, shit." Because I listened to the guys in the barracks, and it was unbelievable what they were talking about. I couldn't believe what they were saying and were doing, you know. And here I was, three guys in the back. I was just waiting to get hurt, you know. So I started talking about me, because I figured that was my best shot, you know.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, they turned out to be pretty nice guys, you know. Dropped me off, and I had a lot of experiences like that. Oh, that was scary.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to Maine after your military time and going to prep school. Where did you go to prep school?
Well, my military time included, I went to Puerto Rico, then I went to California, to El Toro. Then they put me on a ship with a whole bunch of other guys and shipped me to Korea. I went to Sasebo, Japan. Then I went to Korea, Incheon, Korea. Then I went back to Japan. They flew me back to Japan, and I went over there, and I stayed there for a year and a half. Over a year and a half. Oh, it was wonderful duty.
Mm.
It was wonderful. I learned so much over there. People were really nice. I learned a lot about the Japanese people, you know.
Yeah.
But I had a real good experience. I went from buck private to corporal to sergeant. I did real good. And then I took a GED test. I found that I could do even better, you know. So anyway, I'll go back to that later sometime. But it was a wonderful experience. Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got out and I had the GI Bill. So I decided, I went back to construction. Then I decided I'd like to go to college. I went to University of Maine to see if I could get to college. when they found out what my background was, they said, well, we can't take you here, but if you went to down the road, down to Pittsfield, Maine, went to MCI down there for a while, we'd take you. So they told me who to see. So I went down to Pittsfield, and they accepted me. So.
Do you remember the name of the guy you went and saw there?
Well, I was trying to think. Ed Stanley was my big contact.
Uh-huh.
But there was another one before him. I don't remember his name. But Ed Stanley was a wonderful man. He became the headmaster, and he helped me. He helped me a lot. I went to work at the Lancy House in Pittsfield, Maine, as bellhop and dishwasher, and,
mm-hmm.
and cleaning up the place after it was closed. And then I picked up started another business, started washing windows at the school there. I landed with most of the stores up and down Main Street. We had a contract with them washing their windows with a squeegee and a brush, and I'd do that once a week. Turned out to be a good business.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a business painting fences and painting houses and all kinds of things like that. Where I was a GI, I was a little older than some of the other kids, you know. In fact, a hell of a lot older. They were about 15, 16, and I was 21, I think, 20, 21. It was kind of embarrassing a little bit.
Did they fit you in, or did you kind of stand apart from them?
Well, I was a lot bigger than they were, and, you know, a lot older than I was than they were, so I stood apart a little bit. But I melded in pretty good with them. I got along good with the kids over there and had no trouble. They kind of liked me a bit, you know.
Mm. And but was it there that you started to believe that you could succeed educationally?
Yes, I did. I went there 1 year, and then the first year, and then I went back to the brickyard and worked there that summer, and then came back and went back to prep school. And the second year I was there, my mother called me up. She says, Harvey, you've got to help me. Your brother's, he's not listening to me, and I was the oldest one. And I said, well, what do you want me to do, Mom? She says, take him with you up there at the school. I said, well, how am I going to do that? She says, I don't care. You can't handle him. You bring him to school. He goes in one door and out the other, and the principal can't handle him, and we're going to need some help. I said, well, okay. So I went down and got him, borrowed some money from somebody down here. Dr. Marcus lent me $50, I think it was. I don't remember, but anyway. I got some money from him and brought him up there with him and roomed him with me at the Lancy House. And went in, and I saw the headmaster, and I said, my brother's going to go to school with me. He said, how's he going to do that? I said, well, he's going to, my brother, I'm going to have him up here with him and live with me. He says, you can't do that. He says, he's got to go where he comes from. He said, unless you're going to pay for his tuition. I said, I can't do that. He said, well, there's no way he can come to school here. I said, well, so I didn't know what to do then, so I went back, and my brother was helping me raking lawns and things. And I was raking this lawn on this attorney's place, and I got thinking about it. I said, I wonder if I could adopt him. Just the idea came to me, to like that, you know. I went over and knocked on the door, and I said, Mr. So-and-so, I still remember his name, he had a mustache. I said, can I adopt my brother? He said, sure. I said, I can. I said, how much is that going to cost? I think he said $10 or something like that for the papers. I said, well, why don't you do that? And I said, I want to adopt him. So he gave me the papers. I don't know if my mother had to sign them or what happened, but I got the papers, and I got that arranged, paid him, took it off the bill that I was working on with him. I went and see the headmaster as soon as I got the papers done, and I brought him in. I said, my brother's going to come to school here, and I'm going to put the papers in. He said, how's he going to do that? I said, I live here, and he's my dependent. He looked at the papers, and he said, I guess you're right, Harvey. So that's how I got my brother into prep school.
And what's your brother's name?
Edward.
Ed. Okay.
But anyway, that was a lot of fun.
So he went for a year with you?
Well, what happened was I had started my second year, and I had physics, algebra, geometry, trig or something like that. I remember
right.
It was all Chinese to me. I mean, I didn't know. I could remember Bill Bennett, who was one of my roommates up there my first year, trying to teach me about trig, I think it was, or something. I forgot. He said, look, Ivy, I just couldn't get it in my mind that an X or a Z equaled a number. You know, X, Y, Z equals this, that, you know. I still don't know. It was so strange, you know. You take the bananas and the apples, say this is the X and this is the Z and this is the Y, and he would try like hell, you know. There was no way I could get that. So anyway, I had to get done. I went down to see the headmaster. I said, he said, Harvey, he said, don't worry about that. I said, what do you mean? I called him, Ed, Mr. Stanley. I said, Mr. Stanley, what do you mean? He said, I guarantee you I'll get you into the University of Maine. I said, yeah. I said, you might guarantee me to get me in there. That doesn't mean I'm going to be able to stay in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I made up my mind, and I just had to go. So I terminated right then.
Yeah.
And I went. I decided to go down to the VA, Veterans Administration, to take an examination to see if maybe they only have something else I could be suited for. So lo and behold, I went to near Augusta there. I forgot where it was, the VA.
Togus.
I took an examination. They said, well, I said, you know what you want to do is do something with trees. I said, what do you mean? They said, well, your aptitude seems to be leaning in that direction. He said, you've had a lot of experience with trees. And so I said, well, I said, I don't know. I said, well, you could go into logging and stuff like that. I said, I'd like to do something better, different. Well, he said, you could go to Connecticut and work for a company down there. And he said, they teach you all about that. I said, I could. And he said, yeah. He gave me a name of a company called Bartlett Tree Expert Company, I think it was. He said, you go down to Hartford, Connecticut and see them. And he said, they're looking for young people like you that are physically strong and got a good mind. He said, they'll teach you about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And he said, you might be able to qualify for the VA assistance or something. So I said, well, good enough. I went and packed my bags and went to Hartford, Connecticut, and went down there. It was January when I went down there because I had sold Christmas trees that period before that. So after that, that was when I left. Anyway, I went down there, and they said, yeah, we'd love to have you, but you got to come back in May. I said, well, I want a job now. They said, we're not hiring now. We don't hire until it gets warm, and we need people bad. So I said, well, I need jobs. So I went out looking around. I was in Hartford, and I looked around. And I saw a tree company. I just called them up, Camlin and Smith. They said, yeah, they'd give me a job. They were clearing lines for a power company coming up through from New York, I guess. So I went to work for them, and I started cutting, and they liked what I did, and they teamed me up with another guy from Nova Scotia who was like me, had been worked in the woods a lot as a kid. We worked quite well together. We could twist trees around with the lean one way. We knew how to wedge them over and tip them the other way, and they liked that.
Mm.
So they gave me a pretty good job. One night I went out with some of them drinking beer and stuff, and there was a guy there tying ropes and showing people how to do knots and things and how to make what they call rope saddles and bullets and all this stuff that I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I said, what are you doing? You know, he said, well, look at this. And he showed me this and that. I said, boy, I said, you want to try it? I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. Do this, do that. And he showed me how to twist the rope around and try. And we were just drinking, raising hell. You know. He said, you like this, don't you? I said, yeah. I said, throw that rope. I threw the rope. He says, boy, you got a pretty good arm on you. He said, you ought to. You look like a pretty rugged kid. He said, you like this, huh? I said, yeah. I said, you work in the woods? He said, yeah. I said, you think you'd like climbing trees? I said, I'd like to try it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, he said, you've been to school, huh? I said, yeah. Well, I said, I've been to prep school. That's about it. He said, they got a school up there at the University of Massachusetts. It's called Agriculture School. And he said, it's a college. He said, I don't know if you're qualified, but he said, that's what you ought to do is find out about that. So it just happened. I was going out with a girl at the time from the university up there. And I had to go up there the next weekend, and they had a masquerade party. They had a fraternity party. These fraternities get together and drink and raise hell and stuff,
right.
You know. So I didn't know a fraternity from a gravedigger. I didn't know what the hell it was. Mm-hmm. I said, well, come as a disguise, a dress as an old-fashioned guy. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, put on this old-fashioned turby or whatever. I said, what about if I come as Pierre the Woodsman? Yeah, that'd be okay. So I put my, that's all I had. I had my boots, my green woolen pants, you know, my plaid shirt, and I had my little knit hat on, you know, and then suspenders, boots, and I had a peavey, like canned dog, you know.
Uh-huh.
I had a canned dog. So I go up there with dressed up like that in my pickup truck, and I meet her, and she's laughing like hell, you know. So I go in and walk in the place, and I said, who are you? I said, I am Pierre the Woodsman from up to Canada. You know, I said, hey, come on in, Pierre, you know. You know, they're all young guys. And they're all drinking like hell. And I've been in the Marine Corps for 3 years, and we've been having a little bit once in a while, so I was pretty well seasoned to it, you know. So I started drinking. He said, boy, this guy can hold his liquor, you know. So they take me from one room to another, you know. I had a hell of a good time. So they let me sleep there that night in the fraternity, and I had a hell of a good time. Oh, I was Pierre the Woodsman. They want to know all the stories, and I told them all kinds of stories, you know. Oh, it was a lot of fun.
Oh.
Something else I want to tell you about. I don't remember. But oh, I know what it was. The next morning, I said, well, they told me to go see Professor King, Gordon King. And my memory, my association was always a little weak, but I could remember King.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to find out how to get hold of Professor King. And I said, well, he's in this department or that department. I called this department. That. Well, find out he's at the student union. I didn't know what the hell that was. I had to find that. I get to the student union, and I said, Professor King, well, he might be in the barber shop. I go in there, there's about 10 barber chairs in there, you know. I said, Professor King in here. Guy sitting there getting a haircut or something. I said, I'm Professor King, you know. So anyway, I go over and see him. He's in the barber chair. He says, why don't you wait till I get through my haircut and shave or whatever he was doing? He said, I'll talk to you. So he listened to me a while, and I told him I'd only been as far as the eighth grade, but well, he said, I'll tell you what. He said, I never did this before, but he said, maybe there's a place for you. See, that was a two-year course. It was an associate's degree. And they had gone from a non-degree to an associate's degree 2 years before, so it was a new program. But it was an associate's degree, so it was a degree, which was pretty good. But he said, I don't know if you can qualify for that. But he said, I'll tell you what. He says, if you're willing to pack up and go to Acton, Massachusetts, and stay there for a year and work for Frank Charter, who was a certified arborist, and I didn't know they had been to college together. Him and Professor King had been to college together,
right.
So they knew each other quite well. He said, I'll accept you in, just like that.
Mm.
I'll accept you in. I said, yes, sir. So I packed up and went up to Acton, Massachusetts, went to work for Mr. Charter, and got to know him and his wife, and they were really nice to me. Taught me a lot about trees, how to identify them. From a half a mile away almost, you know, by the shape and the way the branches structured, and ones that grew this way and ones that grew that way.
Right.
Well, he was a brilliant, smart man.
Mm.
And he had a master's in forestry or something like that. And he started his own company, and he was a town's tree warden, and he had his own company. Put me right to work, taught me all kinds of things. Technical things, practical things. Was a wonderful education, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got ready to go to college, I had a hell of a background. I had a work background, a good strong work background, a technical background, and I knew a little bit about insects, funguses, diseases, structures, all kinds of things, roots, how they grew, nobody would ever pick up.
Right.
And I went to college, and I learned an awful lot there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was wonderful, wonderful. But anyway, I went up there and came back, and then I got my education. I got to be a real good technician,
mm-hmm.
and I got to be I got my degree, and then I worked. While I was going to college, I started a business, University Students Tree Service. I hired two or three kids who were going to college at the same time. We had to take and do a placement type affair for 2 or 3 months in conjunction with our degree courses.
Right.
And what I did is I started my business, and I worked for quite a few tree wardens in Holyoke, North Holyoke, Springfield, West Springfield. I worked through that whole area. Almost stayed down there. I had such a good business going.
Mm.
Met my first wife there and got married and stayed down there, and I really liked it down there. I really liked it. But I decided I want to come back home to Maine and start up. So as soon as I graduated, I came up here and started a business from scratch, knocking on doors, and I built it up to about 20 men.
Mm-hmm.
We used to work all over the state. Before I started my business, I worked in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine. And I got licenses in New Hampshire and Maine, and I got certified by the Arbor Association of Massachusetts. I was certified in all these areas,
right.
So I could do work in all these states, you know. And then I started in Maine. I started in Lewiston Auburn. I used to have so little business. I used to load my truck up with brush. Sometimes I'd get a tree take down. I'd put the brush on and tie it on and keep it on there for a week sometimes. Go to different coffee shops just so they see my truck with a sign on it, you know.
Yeah.
Anything to get attention, anything. Sometimes I get a tree to take down and be near a street or something. I call a newspaper and say, oh my God, there's somebody up a tree up here and they're taking down this dangerous looking tree and over some wires and over cars. And it's very dangerous. It's kind of scary. And I'd be in a phone booth across the street, you know. Sure enough, whoop, they'd come over and take a picture. And I'd be my guy way up in the tree. You know, I'd go running out and say, can I help you? Honest. That's how I got my business going, a little bit at a time. So I started with one guy one time. He worked for me as I needed him half a day at a time. And he was a mute, dumb and deaf.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't get a job, you know, so I hired him to work for me a little bit. It was a bitch trying to get his attention. I'd be throwing limbs at him and everything because he couldn't hear me, you know. I'd say, hey, he couldn't hear me. I was in love, huh? You know, and he couldn't talk to me. He'd go, oh, you know. It was really something. We did pretty good, though.
Yeah.
He just died last week.
Oh.
Yeah, his name was Layton. But anyway, that's how I got started. And I built it up to about 20 people.
Wow.
Yeah, we did work from Kittery. Sat in Kittery, Portsmouth, did a lot of work down there. Did that big bridge that Chimbro built. We landscaped all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we went all the way up through the, way up the coast, almost to Canada. And we come back up and went up through Augusta, Waterville, up 995 right there, right to Holton. Went up through Aroostook County, up through there, did a lot of work up there. So we were spread pretty thin, developed a lot of equipment. And I had to fly by the seat of my pants, you know, because I didn't have anybody. I had no name. I built my name up. I didn't have anybody to sign the checks for me to back me up and say, you know.
Right.
No, I didn't have any of that. So I did everything on a fly-by-night, a hit-and-miss basis.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do real good. Sometimes I don't do so good. Sometimes I do real poor. But I didn't know anything else, you know.
Yeah.
So that's how I got started.
And did Rachel say you were the first licensed arborist?
Yeah, I was the first one to come up with a college degree and do this kind of work. There was another one that came up about the same time I did, but he went into the skiing business. Then he went into the agriculture business after that.
Oh.
But he didn't have a degree. He had a license to do it, you know,
right.
Which was okay.
Right.
You know, I'm just saying, you
yeah.
know, it was another added feature that I had that I could speak intelligently about trees and discuss
mm-hmm.
the diseases and so forth. Not that people were overly interested in that at that time. They weren't. They just wanted the dead limbs taken out.
Right.
And that's the way people were trained at that time, you know. Today, it's a lot different because of the insurances
yeah.
and the examinations and the watchful eye that a lot of these communities have now.
Right. It's and what was the name of your business?
Mount Appetite. And the name was Mount Appetite because when I was a kid, I grew up near Mount Appetite, and I wanted to have a name other than Joe's Tree Service. Or,
right.
Know, everybody had their name tagged on it, which was okay, but I just wanted to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would say, Appetite, what does that mean? You know, and I'd have to tell them it was a mineral. A lot of times they thought it meant the appetite, you know, it was a mineral. And the name stuck. It started with A, and I was thinking maybe that would be good in the phone book.
In the phone book.
You know? But then I had Mount in front of it, so that threw it off a little bit. But still, Appetite, a lot of them remember Appetite, you know.
Yeah.
So it stuck pretty good. Stuck good.
And,
okay.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, go
okay.
on.
Okay, I was going to say I came up with most of that on my own, but it's not true. I had learned a lot of things from different people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A for Appetite and things like that, and I thought that would be a good name to stick with because when I was a kid, if you were a Frenchman, there were a lot of people would like you, but a lot of people... It was like being a colored person, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean it like it sounds, but there was a stigma there. See, it was
right.
like the Indians and the French and the French and the Germans and the, you know what I mean?
Right.
Well, we went
yep.
through that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And today it's everybody's it's a melting pot. But I guess if you go over there where they're having trouble now today, it's not a melting pot over there.
No.
You know, there's always a friction like that of some type. But I guess the more educated we get, the more we get to know about each other. The more we melt into each other, the more we learn to love each other too, you know,
mm-hmm.
to tolerate each other, to like each other.
Right.
And at that time, I think we're just coming through some of that, you know.
Yeah.
I really think so.
Yeah.
You ever think about that?
Yeah. And I know our challenge in Lewiston and Auburn today is the fairly new Somali population.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge that, you know,
oh, yeah.
we face today. So there's always new challenges.
Well, I think the big thing is we always look at how difficult it is for us. You know, maybe we have a job we really don't like, or maybe we'd like to have a better job, and we feel a threat because these people are coming in and swallowing up some jobs that we think maybe would be available to other people. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there's always that cloud, you know.
Now, did you end your tree business at some point and go on to something else?
Well, what happened is with the tree business and the fact that I had built up to 20 men,
right.
I had to get a lot of work. You know, I had to get volumes. I had to do a lot of bidding. I had to do a lot of schmoozing. I had to do a lot of different things than I had ever done before. I had to learn where the jobs were, how to do it. I had to get bonding. The bigger the jobs got, pretty soon I was doing just under $1 million worth of work.
Mm.
And back then, it was a hell of a lot of money. And you come out just knocking on doors, and all of a sudden, it took a period of time, but $1 million worth of work was a hell of a lot of money.
Right.
Today, it'd be like $5 million worth or more, you know, really. And I had to get in the heavy equipment. So the next thing you know, I got a crane. I got two stump chippers. We used to travel all over the state of Maine chipping out stumps for the towns and so forth. We had the second stump chip in the state, the biggest one. I got the biggest model. It was brand new. And I got a big hydraulic sprayer, John Bean sprayer, to spray these tall elm trees. Big one. And we had to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And we did that. But I wasn't careful. So I got too far out. You know, I got too much equipment.
Mm.
Too big of equipment. So I had to get bigger jobs, more bonding.
Right.
And, you know, to get $50,000, $20,000, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 with the bonding, you've got to have a lot of strong belly to do that, you know, to start with before you get into the big ones. But that's how all contractors get going. So what happened was I got involved in putting up bus shelters for the city of Portland out of masonry bricks and glass blocks and put a little roof on them and so forth. Then I did some heavy work for the colleges, big jobs. Putting in ball fields, running tracks, all kinds of things. And then I got involved in moving large trees. I could move 12, 14-inch diameter trees that would be 40, 50 feet tall. I did some of that for the University of Maine down in Portland. And then I did some for private people. But I did some big jobs. You know, people don't remember that now. And it didn't mean anything, but it did to me. I got pictures of a lot of them and things. But that's all gone by now. I really enjoyed my work a hell of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it a lot. I miss it.
Yeah. And tell me about your time as a shoe worker.
Well, that's when I was about 16, maybe. I think it's about 15 or 16. And it was after I got out of the brickyard in the summer. It was cold. I cut Christmas trees, and after Christmas tree season, I used to do that every year, Christmas tree. I got a hell of a business going doing that too. But anyway, after Christmas tree season, I wanted some more work, and I wanted to get inside where it was warm because it was pretty cold outside in the winter. So I found out maybe I could get a job in a shoe shop because there used to be a lot of shoe shops around here. There were a lot of them. There were 50, 60, 70, 80. It seemed like there was hundreds of them between Lewis and Love, and they were everywhere. And anyway, I went and got a job in there. They hired me. I got a job, and that's all I did. It was a last puller, and that means that what you do is take the last out of the inside of the shoe. The last is a form that they build a shoe on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wooden item that has a hinge inside of it. It's flat. It sets flat on the table or whatever when you use it, and you build a shoe around it. And then when you get the shoe all built, you don't need the last in this. You got to pull the last out. So they got a last is a thing that's on a bench, like a big spike, and you take the last, and you take the heel of the last, the inside, and you stick it on there, and there's a hole, sticks in there, and there's a hinge inside that last, push down on it, and it bends down like that, and you slide the shoe off in it.
Uh-huh.
And then you just push the last up straight and throw it into a rack, and then you do that all day. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I had good arms from working in the brickyard in the woods, so they made me the last puller, and that's what I did all winter.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in pretty good shape. That was before I went in the Marine Corps, too, you know. So having pulled last like that all winter, working in the brickyard in the summertime, working in the woods in the wintertime, and then I drove a grain truck handling 80, 100 pound bags of grain all alone. Load the truck alone, unload it alone, take it to these farms all over Hebron, Buckfield, some in the west, some in all these little towns. I used to take that. That was before they got in blowing grain in these big trucks. We used to haul it in by bags.
Right.
And some of these hen houses were 3 floors high. You had to carry the bag on your shoulder and go up 3 floors to the top.
Wow.
Carry them up there, you know. And then some others had elevators that they would bring the grain up. They have a little belt with the cups on them, you know.
Yeah.
They would do that too. But many of them didn't. And you used to have to carry up. So needless to say, I got in pretty good shape. The guys used to come right with me. They were going to high school because I had quit school. And we used to fool around and lift bags of grain like they were weights, you know, and stuff like that. And of course, I could lift pretty good. You know? So they liked me. But anyway, that was the last pull in the grain truck and stuff. It all went together, you know.
Right.
In those days, like I said, that's going to be coming back. It's coming back now. We did all kinds of jobs, you know. Then we went through a period there for 20, 30 years, where 40 years, they wanted a job they could stick and retire from it because they get the retirement, whether it was for the state, the federal government, or the town, or corporation, or whatever it was. But now, it's not like that anymore.
Yeah.
Unless you're a teacher, unless you work for a community, it is like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much longer it'll be like that. Maybe it'll be like that forever.
Hmm.
But you know, we've gone through these changes.
Yeah. And Rachel asked me to ask you about how you came to go to France and where you were in Rockland at the time, and what was that job, and how did you get the opportunity?
What happened, as my business grew, I found it on the coast, it was pretty heavy. You know, I seemed to get more work on the coast because there's more estates down there, people had more money or something.
Right.
And they're more sophisticated. Some they had traveled more, so they understood the beauty of a tree and so forth, and they wanted their trees a certain way. So I started picking up more work that way, and I started working for Rockland, Thomaston, Camden, these towns, and got more and more work. So I decided, well, my first wife liked the coast, and I kind of liked it. So she talked me into buying a piece of property on Harper's Island, which was near Port Clyde. And I moved up there. So I bought a piece of property on Harper's Island. I built a place up there, a chalet, which I should have never done. I must have put over $100,000 into that out of my pocket. And then all of a sudden, things got tough. And I wasn't getting the contracts.
Yeah.
So I ended up losing everything. And in the process, I got a job working for a fish factory because I wanted a job. I went down to try to collect unemployment. I never collected unemployment. I was limping, and my arm was in a sling. I had tennis elbow, so the doctor at that time, they had a little, they'd chip it out. They didn't do like they do today. And I had to keep my arm in a sling for a week or two. And I stepped off a porch, I twisted my ankle. So I went down to the employment office, my arm in a sling, and I'm limping. And they said, what happened to you? I said, well, I just got a little tennis elbow. How come you're limping? I said, well, I slipped off the porch and it's just twisted. Well, you're not hired. You can't be hired for work like that. So we can't help you here. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, you can't be fit for work. If you can be fit for work, then we can help you somehow. I said, well, I can still move my arm. He said, no. So I figured out where I was in that office, and I went out the door, and I said, come back the next day, and I took my arm. Would have done this when I made sure I could walk pretty good, and I went to another desk. So anyway, I got the unemployment insurance. In the process, they found me this job at the fish factory, so I went down to get the job. And my job was to cook all the fish that was not beyond human consumption. In other words, it was full of maggots.
Right.
Or the ship came in loaded with fish, and there were so many ships ahead of them, they couldn't get it out fast enough, so the ships start to spoil, so they have to get rid of it. They couldn't dump it in the ocean. So they had this factory right in Port Clyde, in Rockland, called Seapro. It would take all this fish that was spoiled, bring it in there and dump it on the floor, on a big cement floor, big piles of it, full of maggots and everything else, you know, and shovel it in this machine. And this machine was a big, like a kiln. It was a big, well, it was like a cement kiln.
Right.
Thing turns like that. They put it in one end. And it revolves real slowly, and there's a lot of heat and steam and everything in the this thing, this double jacket thing, and this porthole so you can see what's going on. I mean, a big unit, long as this room here, big one.
Wow.
And we'd cook all this fish, and it would cook it in a mealy material. It would go through what they call a spinner. It would drop in there, and it would be like a mush, you know, and it would go through this spinner, and all the oil would come out of it, and all the water. And that would settle, and then the water, and the oil would settle away from the water, and that would be used for DeRusto paint, which I never knew before, and some other things. Then it would take all the other flakes and drop into another unit, and they'd dry them with heat and so forth, and make cat food out of it, pet food and stuff.
Yes.
So nothing to be spoiled. Maggots, everything, heads, eyeballs, everything. Everything we used up.
Yeah, no waste.
No waste. So anyway, one day I'm unloading this 60-foot trailer with another guy with big forks, unloading this fish. And the fish, the foreman comes out and says, "Hey, Harvey." He looked up at me like this. "Hey, Harvey, you talk French?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "No shit." He said, "Yeah, get down here." I get down. He said, "Wash off of this hose." He's got a rubber suit on, rubber pants, rubber jacket, you know, because the stuff was all over me. Wash it off. He said, "Come in the office here." Takes me in the office. He says, "Hey, everybody, Harvey can talk French." "No." "Yeah. Say something, Harvey." So I said something in French, very derogatory, because I was working with laboring type people, you know. I can't repeat it. But I said something very derogatory. He said, "My God, he can talk French." I didn't know what the hell I was talking about.
Right. So hold on, I want to